This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Chronicles of Narnia, Book 4, Prince Caspian by C.S. Lewis. Read by Lynn Redgrave. Chapter 1, The Island. Once there were four children whose names were Peter, Susan, Edmund and Lucy, and it has been told in another book called The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe how they had a remarkable adventure. They had opened the door of a magic wardrobe and found themselves in a quite different world from ours, and in that different world they had become kings and queens in a country called Narnia. While they were in Narnia, they seemed to reign for years and years, but when they came back through the door and found themselves in England again, it all seemed to have taken no time at all. At any rate, no one noticed that they had ever been away, and they never told anyone except one very wise grown-up. That had all happened a year ago, and now all four of them were sitting on a seat at a railway station with trunks and play boxes piled up around them. They were, in fact, on their way back to school. They had travelled together as far as this station, which was a junction, and here, in a few minutes, one train would arrive and take the girls away to one school, and in about half an hour, another train would arrive and the boys would go off to another school. The first part of the journey, when they were all together, always seemed to be part of the holidays. But now, when they would be saying goodbye and going different ways so soon, everyone felt that the holidays were really over, and everyone felt their term-time feeling beginning again, and they were all rather gloomy, and no one could think of anything to say. Lucy was going to boarding school for the first time. It was an empty, sleepy country station, and there was hardly anyone on the platform except themselves. Suddenly, Lucy gave a sharp little cry, like someone who has been stung by a wasp. "What's up, Lou?" said Edmund, and then suddenly broke off and made a noise like, "Ow!" "What on earth?" began Peter, and then he too suddenly changed what he had been going to say. Instead he said, "Susan, let go! What are you doing? What are you dragging me to?" "I'm not touching you," said Susan. "Someone is pulling me! Oh! 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 Stop it!" Everyone noticed that all the others' faces had gone very white. "I felt just the same," said Edmund in a breathless voice, "as if I were being dragged along, most frightful pulling. Ah, it's beginning again." "Me too," said Lucy. "Oh, I can't bear it."
"Look sharp," shouted Edmund. "All catch hands and keep together. This is magic. I can tell by the feeling. Quick."
"Yes," said Susan. "Hold hands. Oh, I do wish it would stop. Oh!"
Next moment, the luggage, the seat, the platform and the station had completely vanished. The four children, holding hands and panting, found themselves standing in a woody place, such a woody place that branches were sticking into them and there was hardly room to move. They all rubbed their eyes and took a deep breath.
"Oh, Peter," exclaimed Lucy, "do you think we can possibly have got back to Narnia?"
"It might be anywhere," said Peter. "I can't see a yard in all these trees. Let's try to get into the open, if there is any open."
With some difficulty and with some stings from nettles and pricks from thorns, they struggled out of the thicket. Then they had another surprise. Everything became much brighter, and after a few steps they found themselves at the edge of the wood, looking down on a sandy beach. A few yards away, a very calm sea was falling on the sand with such tiny ripples that it made hardly any sound. There was no land in sight and no clouds in the sky. The sun was about where it ought to be at 10 o'clock in the morning, and the sea was a dazzling blue. They stood sniffing in the sea smell.
"By Jove," said Peter, "this is good enough."
5 minutes later, everyone was barefooted and wading in the cool, clear water.
"This is better than being in a stuffy train on the way back to Latin and French and algebra," said Edmund.
And then, for quite a long time, there was no more talking, only splashing and looking for shrimps and crabs.
"All the same," said Susan presently, "I suppose we'll have to make some plans.
"'We shall want something to eat before long.' "'We've got the sandwiches Mother gave us for the journey,' said Edmund. "'At least I've got mine.'
"'Not me,' said Lucy. "'Mine were in my little bag.'
"'So were mine,' said Susan. "'Mine are in my coat pocket, there on the beach,' said Peter. "'That'll be two lunches among four. "'This isn't going to be such fun.'
"'A present,' said Lucy. "'I want something to drink more than something to eat.'
Everyone else now felt thirsty, as one usually is after wading in salt water under a hot sun. "'It's like being shipwrecked,' remarked Edmund. "'In the books, they always find springs of clear, fresh water on the island. "'We'd better go and look for them.'
"'Does that mean we have to go back into all that thick wood?'
said Susan. "'Not a bit of it,' said Peter. "'If there are streams, they're bound to come down to the sea, "'and if we walk along the beach, we're bound to come to them.' They all now waded back and went first across the smooth, wet sand and then up to the dry, crumbly sand that sticks to one's toes and began putting on their shoes and socks. Edmund and Lucy wanted to leave them behind and do their exploring with bare feet, but Susan said this would be a mad thing to do.
"'We might never find them again,' she pointed out, "'and we shall want them if we're still here when night comes and it begins to be cold.'
When they were dressed again... They set out along the shore with the sea on their left hand and the wood on their right. Except for an occasional seagull, it was a very quiet place. The wood was so thick and tangled that they could hardly see into it at all, and nothing in it moved. Not a bird, not even an insect. Shells and seaweed and anemones, or tiny crabs in rock pools, are all very well, but you soon get tired of them if you are thirsty. The children's feet, after the change from the cool water, felt hot and heavy. Susan and Lucy had raincoats to carry. Edmund had put down his coat on the station seat just before the magic overtook them, and he and Peter took it in turns to carry Peter's great coat. Presently, the shore began to curve round to the right. About quarter of an hour later, after they had crossed a rocky ridge which ran out into a point, it made quite a sharp turn. Their backs were now to the part of the sea which had met them when they first came out of the wood, and now, looking ahead, they could see across the water another shore, thickly wooded like the one they were exploring.
"'I wonder, is that an island, or do we join on to it presently?' said Lucy.
"'Don't know,' said Peter." And they all plodded on in silence. The shore that they were walking on drew nearer and nearer to the opposite shore, and as they came round each promontory, the children expected to find the place where the two joined. But in this they were disappointed. They came to some rocks which they had to climb, and from the top they could see a fair way ahead, and...
"'Oh, bother!' said Edmund. "'It's no good. We shan't be able to get to those other woods at all.' "'We're on an island!'
It was true. At this point, the channel between them and the opposite coast was only about 30 or 40 yards wide, but they could now see that this was its narrowest place. After that, their own coast bent round to the right again, and they could see open sea between it and the mainland. It was obvious that they had already come much more than halfway round the island.
"'Look!' said Lucy suddenly. "'What's that?'
She pointed to a long, silvery, snake-like thing that lay across the beach.
"'A stream! A stream!' shouted the others, and tired as they were, they lost no time in clattering down the rocks and racing to the fresh water.
They knew that the stream would be better to drink farther up, away from the beach, so they went at once to the spot where it came out of the wood. The trees were as thick as ever, but the stream had made itself a deep course between high mossy banks, so that by stooping you could follow it up in a sort of tunnel of leaves. They dropped on their knees by the first brown, dimply pool, and drank and drank, and dipped their faces in the water, and then dipped their arms in up to the elbow.
"'Now,' said Edmund, "'what about those sandwiches?'
"'Oh, hadn't we better save them?' said Susan. "'We may need them far worse later on.'
"'I do wish,' said Lucy, "'now that we're not thirsty, "'we could go on feeling as not hungry "'as we did when we were thirsty.'
"'But what about those sandwiches?' repeated Edmund.
"'There's no good saving them till they go bad. "'You've got to remember it's a good deal hotter here than in England, "'and we've been carrying them about in pockets for hours.'
So they got out the two packets and divided them into four portions, and nobody had quite enough, but it was a great deal better than nothing. Then they talked about their plans for the next meal. Lucy wanted to go back to the sea and catch shrimps, until someone pointed out that they had no nets. Edmund said they must gather gulls' eggs from the rocks, but when they came to think of it, they couldn't remember having seen any gulls' eggs, and wouldn't be able to cook them if they found any. Peter thought to himself that unless they had some stroke of luck, they would soon be glad to eat eggs raw, but he didn't see any point in saying this out loud. Susan said it was a pity they had eaten the sandwiches so soon. One or two tempers very nearly got lost at this stage. Finally, Edmund said, "Look here, there's only one thing to be done. We must explore the wood. Hermits and knights-errant and people like that always manage to live somehow if they're in a forest. They find roots and berries and things." "What sort of roots?" asked Susan.
"I always thought it meant roots of trees," said Lucy.
"Come on," said Peter. "Ed is right, and we must try to do something. It'll be better than going out into the glare and the sun again." So they all got up and began to follow the stream. It was very hard work. They had to stoop under branches and climb over branches, and they blundered through great masses of stuff like rhododendrons and tore their clothes and got their feet wet in the stream. And still there was no noise at all, except the noise of the stream and the noises they were making themselves. They were beginning to get very tired of it when they noticed a delicious smell and then a flash of bright colour high above them at the top of the right bank.
"I say," exclaimed Lucy, "I do believe that's an apple tree."
It was. They panted up the steep bank, forced their way through some brambles, and found themselves standing round an old tree that was heavy with large, yellowish-golden apples, as firm and juicy as you could wish to see.
"And this is not the only tree," said Edmund, with his mouth full of apple. "Look there, and there."
"Why, there are dozens of them,"
said Susan, throwing away the core of her first apple and picking her second.
"This must have been an orchard, long, long ago, before the place went wild and the wood grew up."
"Then this was once an inhabited island," said Peter.
"And what's that?" said Lucy, pointing ahead.
"By Jove, it's a wall," said Peter.
"An old stone wall."
Pressing their way between the laden branches, they reached the wall. It was very old and broken down in places, with moss and wallflowers growing on it, but it was higher than all but the tallest trees. And when they came quite close to it, they found a great arch, which must once have had a gate in it, but was now almost filled up with the largest of all the apple trees. They had to break some of the branches to get past, and when they had done so, they all blinked because the daylight became suddenly much brighter. They found themselves in a wide open place with walls all round it. In here there were no trees, only level grass and daisies and ivy and grey walls. It was a bright, secret, quiet place and rather sad. And all four stepped out into the middle of it, glad to be able to straighten their backs and move their limbs freely. Chapter 2. The Ancient Treasure House.
"This wasn't a garden," said Susan presently. "It was a castle, and this must have been the courtyard."
"I see what you mean," said Peter. "Yes, that is the remains of a tower, and there is what used to be a flight of steps going up to the top of the walls. And look at those other steps, the broad, shallow ones going up to that doorway. It must have been the door into the great hall."
"Ages ago, by the look of it," said Edmund.
"Yes, ages ago," said Peter. "I wish we could find out who the people were that lived in this castle, and how long ago."
"It gives me a queer feeling," said Lucy.
"Does it, Lou?" said Peter, turning and looking hard at her. "Because it does the same to me. It is the queerest thing that has happened this queer day. I wonder where we are, and what it all means." While they were talking, they had crossed the courtyard and gone through the other doorway into what had once been the hall. This was now very like the courtyard, for the roof had long since disappeared, and it was merely another space of grass and daisies, except that it was shorter and narrower, and the walls were higher. Across the far end, there was a kind of terrace about 3 feet higher than the rest.
"I wonder, was it really the hall?" said Susan. "What is that terrace kind of thing?"
"Why, you silly," said Peter, who had become strangely excited. "Don't you see? That was the dais where the high table was, where the king and the great lord sat. Anyone would think you had forgotten that we ourselves were once kings and queens and sat on a dais just like that in our great hall."
"In our castle of Caer Paravel," continued Susan in a dreamy and rather sing-song voice, "at the mouth of the great river of Narnia. How could I forget?"
"How it all comes back," said Lucy. "We could pretend we were in Caer Paravel now. This hall must have been very like the great hall we feasted in."
"But unfortunately without the feast," said Edmund. "It's getting late, you know. Look how long the shadows are. And have you noticed that it isn't so hot?"
"We shall need a campfire if we've got to spend the night here," said Peter. "I've got matches. Let's go and see if we can collect some dry wood."
Everyone saw the sense of this, and for the next half hour they were busy. The orchard through which they had first come into the ruins turned out not to be a good place for firewood. They tried the other side of the castle, passing out of the hall by a little side door into a maze of stony humps and hollows, which must once have been passages and smaller rooms, but was now all nettles and wild roses. Beyond this, they found a wide gap in the castle wall and stepped through it into a wood of darker and bigger trees, where they found dead branches and rotten wood and sticks and dry leaves and fir cones in plenty. They went to and fro with bundles until they had a good pile on the dais. At the fifth journey, they found the well, just outside the hall, hidden in weeds, but clean and fresh and deep when they had cleared these away. The remains of a stone pavement ran halfway round it. Then the girls went out to pick some more apples, and the boys built the fire on the dais, and fairly close to the corner between two walls, which they thought would be the snuggest and warmest place. They had great difficulty in lighting it, and used a lot of matches, but they succeeded in the end. Finally, all four sat down with their backs to the wall and their faces to the fire. They tried roasting some of the apples on the ends of sticks, but roast apples are not much good without sugar, and they are too hot to eat with your fingers till they are too cold to be worth eating. So they had to content themselves with raw apples, which, as Edmund said, made one realise that school suppers weren't so bad after all.
"I shouldn't mind a good thick slice of bread and margarine this minute," he added.
But the spirit of adventure was rising in them all, and no one really wanted to be back at school. Shortly after the last apple had been eaten, Susan went out to the well to get another drink. When she came back, she was carrying something in her hand.
"Look," she said in a rather choking kind of voice, "I found it by the well."
She handed it to Peter and sat down. The others thought she looked and sounded as if she might be going to cry. Edmund and Lucy eagerly bent forward to see what was in Peter's hand, a little bright thing that gleamed in the firelight.
"Well, I'm jiggered," said Peter, and his voice also sounded queer.
Then he handed it to the others. All now saw what it was, a little chess knight. Ordinary in size, but extraordinarily heavy, because it was made of pure gold, and the eyes in the horse's head were two tiny little rubies. Or rather, one was, for the other had been knocked out.
"Why," said Lucy, "it's exactly like one of the golden chessmen we used to play with when we were kings and queens at Caer Paravel."
"Cheer up, Sue," said Peter to his other sister.
"I can't help it," said Susan. "It brought back, oh, such lovely times. And I remembered playing chess with fauns and good giants and the mer-people singing in the sea and my beautiful horse and...
"Now," said Peter in a quite different voice, "it's about time we four started using our brains."
"What about?" asked Edmund.
"Have none of you guessed where we are?" said Peter.
"Go on, go on," said Lucy. "I felt for hours that there was some wonderful mystery hanging over this place."
Fire ahead, Peter, said Edmund. We're all listening. We are in the ruins of Caer Paravel itself, said Peter.
But I say, replied Edmund, I mean, how do you make that out? This place has been ruined for ages. Look at all those big trees growing right up to the gates. Look at the very stones. Anyone can see that nobody has lived here for hundreds of years.
I know, said Peter. That is the difficulty. But let's leave that out for the moment. I want to take the points one by one. First point. This hall is exactly the same shape and size as the hall at Caer Paravel. Just picture a roof on this and a coloured pavement instead of grass and tapestries on the walls and you get our royal banqueting hall. No one said anything. Second point, continued Peter, the castle well is exactly where our well was, a little to the south of the great hall, and it is exactly the same size and shape. Again, there was no reply. Third point, Susan has just found one of our old chessmen, or something as like one of them as two peas. Still, nobody answered. Fourth point, don't you remember? It was the very day before the ambassadors came from the King of Calormen. Don't you remember planting the orchard outside the north gate of Caer Paravel? The greatest of all the wood people, Pomona herself, came to put good spells on it. It was those very decent little chaps, the moles, who did the actual digging. Can you have forgotten that funny old Lily Gloves, the chief mole, leaning on his spade and saying, "Believe me, Your Majesty, you'll be glad of these fruit trees one day." And by Jove, he was right.
I do, said Lucy and clapped her hands.
But look here, Peter, said Edmund. This must be all rot. To begin with, we didn't plant the orchard slap up against the gate. We wouldn't have been such fools. No, of course not, said Peter. But it has grown up to the gate since.
And for another thing, said Edmund, Caer Paravel wasn't on an island.
Yes, I've been wondering about that. But it was a, what do you call it? A peninsula, jolly nearly an island. Couldn't it have been made an island since our time? Somebody has dug a channel.
But half a moment, said Edmund. You keep on saying, since our time, but it's only a year ago since we came back from Narnia. And you want to make it out that in 1 year, castles have fallen down, and great forests have grown up, and little trees we saw planted ourselves have turned into a big old orchard, and goodness knows what else. It's all impossible.
There's one thing, said Lucy. If this is Caer Paravel, there ought to be a door at this end of the dais. In fact, we ought to be sitting with our backs against it at this moment. You know, the door that led down to the treasure chamber?
I suppose there isn't a door, said Peter, getting up. The wall behind them was a mass of ivy.
We can soon find out, said Edmund, taking up one of the sticks that they had laid ready for putting on the fire.
He began beating the ivied wall. Tap, tap, went the stick against the stone, and again, tap, tap, and then all at once, boom, boom, with a quite different sound, a hollow wooden sound.
Great Scott, said Edmund.
We must clear this ivy away, said Peter.
Oh, do let's leave it alone, said Susan. We can try it in the morning. If we've got to spend the night here, I don't want an open door at my back and a great big black hole that anything might come out of, besides the draught and the damp, and it'll soon be dark.
Susan, how can you? Said Lucy with a reproachful glance.
But both the boys were too much excited to take any notice of Susan's advice. They worked at the ivy with their hands and with Peter's pocket knife till the knife broke. After that, they used Edmund's. Soon, the whole place where they had been sitting was covered with ivy. And at last, they had the door cleared.
Locked, of course, said Peter.
But the wood's all rotten, said Edmund. We can pull it to bits in no time, and it will make extra firewood. Come on!
It took them longer than they expected, and before they had done, the great hall had grown dusky, and the first star or two had come out overhead. Susan was not the only one who felt a slight shudder as the boys stood above the pile of splintered wood, rubbing the dirt off their hands and staring into the cold, dark opening they had made.
"Now for a torch," said Peter.
Oh, what is the good? Said Susan. And as Edmund said...
I'm not saying it now, Edmund interrupted. I still don't understand, but we can settle that later. I suppose you're coming down, Peter?
We must, said Peter. Cheer up, Susan. It's no good behaving like kids now that we are back in Narnia. You're a queen here, and anyway, no one could go to sleep with a mystery like this on their minds.
They tried to use long sticks as torches, but this was not a success. If you held them with the lighted end up, they went out, and if you held them the other way, they scorched your hand and the smoke got in your eyes. In the end, they had to use Edmund's electric torch. Luckily, it had been a birthday present less than a week ago, and the battery was almost new. He went first with the light. Then came Lucy, then Susan, and Peter brought up the rear.
"I've come to the top of the steps," said Edmund.
"Count them," said Peter. "One, two, three," said Edmund, as he went cautiously down, and so up to 16.
"And this is the bottom," he shouted back.
"Then it really must be Cair Paravel," said Lucy. "There were 16.
Nothing more was said till all four were standing in a knot together at the foot of the stairway. Then Edmund flashed his torch slowly round.
"Oh!"
said all the children at once. For now all knew that it was indeed the ancient treasure chamber of Cair Paravel, where they had once reigned as kings and queens of Narnia. There was a kind of path up the middle, as it might be in a greenhouse, and along each side at intervals stood rich suits of armour, like knights guarding the treasures. In between the suits of armour and on each side of the path were shelves covered with precious things, necklaces and arm rings and finger rings and golden bowls and dishes and long tusks of ivory, brooches and coronets and chains of gold and heaps of unset stones lying piled anyhow as if they were marbles or potatoes, diamonds, rubies, carbuncles, emeralds, topazes and amethysts. Under the shelves stood great chests of oak, strengthened with iron bars and heavily padlocked. And it was bitterly cold, and so still that they could hear themselves breathing, and the treasures were so covered with dust that unless they had realised where they were, and remembered most of the things, they would hardly have known they were treasures. There was something sad and a little frightening about the place, because it all seemed so forsaken and long ago. That was why nobody said anything for at least a minute. Then, of course, they began walking about and picking things up to look at. It was like meeting very old friends. If you had been there, you would have heard them saying things like,
"Oh, look! Our coronation rings! Do you remember first wearing this? Why, this is the little brooch we all thought was lost. I say, isn't that the armour you wore in the great tournament in the Lone Islands? Do you remember the dwarf making that for me? Do you remember drinking out of that horn? Do you remember? Do you remember?"
But suddenly Edmund said,
"Look here, we mustn't waste the battery. Goodness knows how often we shall need it. Hadn't we better take what we want and get out again?"
"We must take the gifts," said Peter,
for long ago at Christmas in Narnia, he and Susan and Lucy had been given certain presents which they valued more than their whole kingdom. Edmund had had no gift because he was not with them at the time. This was his own fault, and you can read about it in the other book. They all agreed with Peter and walked up the path to the wall at the far end of the treasure chamber. And there, sure enough, the gifts were still hanging. Lucy's was the smallest, for it was only a little bottle, but the bottle was made of diamond instead of glass, and it was still more than half full of the magical cordial which would heal almost every wound and every illness. Lucy said nothing and looked very solemn as she took her gift down from its place and slung the belt over her shoulder and once more felt the bottle at her side, where it used to hang in the old days. Susan's gift had been a bow and arrows and a horn. The bow was still there, and the ivory quiver full of well-feathered arrows, but...
"Oh, Susan," said Lucy, "where's the horn?"
"Oh, bother, bother, bother," said Susan after she had thought for a moment. "I remember now.
I took it with me the last day of all, the day we went hunting the white stag. It must have got lost when we blundered back into that other place. England, I mean.
Edmund whistled. It was indeed a shattering loss, for this was an enchanted horn, and whenever you blew it, help was certain to come to you wherever you were.
"Just the sort of thing that might have come in handy in a place like this," said Edmund. "Never mind," said Susan. "I've still got the bow."
And she took it.
"Won't the string be perished, Sue?" said Peter.
But whether by some magic in the air of the treasure chamber or not, the bow was still in working order. Archery and swimming were the things Susan was good at. In a moment she had bent the bow, and then she gave one little pluck to the string. It twanged, a chirruping twang that vibrated through the whole room, and that one small noise brought back the old days to the children's minds more than anything that had happened yet. All the battles and hunts and feasts came rushing into their heads together. Then she unstrung the bow again and slung the quiver at her side. Next, Peter took down his gift, the shield with the great red lion on it and the royal sword. He blew and wrapped them on the floor to get off the dust. He fitted the shield on his arm and slung the sword by his side. He was afraid at first that it might be rusty and stick to the sheath, but it was not so. With one swift motion, he drew it and held it up, shining in the torchlight.
"It is my sword Rindon," he said. "With it I killed the wolf."
There was a new tone in his voice, and the others all felt that he was really Peter the High King again. Then, after a little pause, everyone remembered that they must save the battery. They climbed the stairs again and made up a good fire and lay down close together for warmth. The ground was very hard and uncomfortable, but they fell asleep in the end.
Chapter 3. The Dwarf.
The worst of sleeping out of doors is that you wake up so dreadfully early, and when you wake you have to get up because the ground is so hard that you are uncomfortable, and it makes matters worse if there is nothing but apples for breakfast, and you have had nothing but apples for supper the night before. When Lucy had said, truly enough, that it was a glorious morning, there did not seem to be anything else nice to be said. Edmund said what everyone was feeling. "We've simply got to get off this island." When they had drunk from the well and splashed their faces, they all went down the stream again to the shore and stared at the channel which divided them from the mainland.
"We'll have to swim," said Edmund.
"It would be all right for Sue," said Peter. Susan had won prizes for swimming at school. "But I don't know about the rest of us."
By the rest of us he really meant Edmund, who couldn't yet do two lengths at the school bars, and Lucy, who could hardly swim at all.
"Anyway," said Susan, "there may be currents. Father says it's never wise to bathe in a place you don't know." "But, Peter," said Lucy, "look here. I know I can't swim for nuts at home, in England, I mean, but couldn't we all swim long ago, if it was long ago, when we were kings and queens in Narnia? We could ride then, too, and do all sorts of things, don't you think?"
"Ah, but we were sort of grown up then," said Peter. "We reigned for years and years and learned to do things. Aren't we just back at our proper ages again now?"
"Oh,"
said Edmund, in a voice which made everyone stop talking and listen to him.
"I've just seen it all," he said.
"Seen what?" asked Peter.
"Why, the whole thing," said Edmund. "You know what we were puzzling about last night? That it was only a year ago since we left Narnia, but everything looks as if no one had lived in Caer Paravel for hundreds of years? Well, don't you see? You know that however long we seem to have lived in Narnia, when we got back through the wardrobe, it seemed to have taken no time at all?"
"Go on," said Susan. "I think I'm beginning to understand."
"And that means," continued Edmund, "that once you're out of Narnia, you have no idea how Narnian time is going. Why shouldn't hundreds of years have gone past in Narnia, while only 1 year has passed for us in England?"
"By Jove, Ed," said Peter, "I believe you've got it. In that sense, it really was hundreds of years ago that we lived in Caer Paravel, and now we're coming back to Narnia just as if we were Crusaders or Anglo-Saxons or ancient Britons or someone coming back to modern England.
How excited they'll all be to see us,
began Lucy, but at the same moment everyone else said, hush, or look, for now something was happening. There was a wooded point on the mainland, a little to their right, and they all felt sure that just beyond that point must be the mouth of the river. And now, round that point, there came into sight a boat. When it had cleared the point, it turned and began coming along the channel towards them. There were two people on board, one rowing, the other sitting in the stern and holding a bundle that twitched and moved as if it were alive. Both these people seemed to be soldiers. They had steel caps on their heads and light shirts of chain mail. Their faces were bearded and hard. The children drew back from the beach into the wood and watched them without moving a finger. "This'll do," said the soldier in the stern, when the boat had come about opposite to them.
"What about tying a stone to his feet, Corporal?" said the other, resting on his oars.
"Gone," growled the other. "We don't need that. And we haven't brought one. He'll drown sure enough without a stone as long as we've tied the cords right."
With these words, he rose and lifted his bundle. Peter now saw that it was really alive, and was in fact a dwarf, bound hand and foot, but struggling as hard as he could. Next moment, he heard a twang just beside his ear, and all at once the soldier threw up his arms, dropping the dwarf into the bottom of the boat, and fell over into the water. He floundered away to the far bank, and Peter knew that Susan's arrow had struck his helmet. He turned and saw that she was very pale, but was already fitting a second arrow to the string. But it was never used. As soon as he saw his companion fall, the other soldier, with a loud cry, jumped out of the boat on the far side, and he also floundered through the water, which was apparently just in his depth, and disappeared into the woods of the mainland.
"Quick, before she drifts!" shouted Peter.
He and Susan, fully dressed as they were, plunged in, and before the water was up to their shoulders, their hands were on the side of the boat. In a few seconds, they had hauled her to the bank and lifted the dwarf out, and Edmund was busily engaged in cutting his bonds with the pocket knife. Peter's sword would have been sharper, but a sword is very inconvenient for this sort of work, because you can't hold it anywhere lower than the hilt. When at last the dwarf was free, he sat up, rubbed his arms and legs, and exclaimed,
"Well, whatever they say, you don't feel like ghosts."
Like most dwarfs, he was very stocky and deep-chested. He would have been about 3 feet high if he'd been standing up, and an immense beard and whiskers of coarse red hair left little of his face to be seen, except a beak-like nose and twinkling black eyes.
"Anyway," he continued, "ghosts or not, you've saved my life, and I'm extremely obliged to you."
"But why should we be ghosts?" asked Lucy.
"I've been told all my life," said the dwarf, "that these woods along the shore were as full of ghosts as they were of trees. That's what the story is. And that's why, when they want to get rid of anyone, they usually bring him down here, like they were doing with me, and say they'll leave him to the ghosts. But I always wondered if they didn't really drown them or cut their throats. I never quite believed in the ghosts. But those two cowards you've just shot believed, all right. They were more frightened of taking me to my death than I was of going."
"Oh," said Susan, "so that's why they both ran away."
"Eh? What's that?" said the dwarf.
"They got away," said Edmund, "to the mainland." "I wasn't shooting to kill, you know," said Susan. She would not have liked anyone to think she could miss at such short range.
"Hmm," said the dwarf. "That's not so good. That may mean trouble later on, unless they hold their tongues for their own sake."
"What were they going to drown you for?" asked Peter.
"Oh, I'm a dangerous criminal, I am," said the dwarf cheerfully. "But that's a long story. Meantime, I was wondering if perhaps you were going to ask me to breakfast. You've no idea what an appetite it gives one, being executed."
"There's only apples," said Lucy dolefully.
"Better than nothing, but not so good as fresh fish," said the dwarf. "It looks as if I'll have to ask you to breakfast instead." I saw some fishing tackle in that boat, and anyway, we must take her round to the other side of the island. We don't want anyone from the mainland coming down and seeing her.
I ought to have thought of that myself, said Peter.
The four children and the dwarf went down to the water's edge, pushed off the boat with some difficulty, and scrambled aboard. The dwarf at once took charge. The oars were, of course, too big for him to use, so Peter rowed, and the dwarf steered them north along the channel, and presently eastward round the tip of the island. From here the children could see right up the river and all the bays and headlands of the coast beyond it. They thought they could recognise bits of it, but the woods which had grown up since their time made everything look very different. When they had come round into open sea on the east of the island, the dwarf took to fishing. They had an excellent catch of pavanders, a beautiful rainbow-coloured fish which they all remembered eating in Caer Paravel in the old days. When they had caught enough, they ran the boat up into a little creek and moored her to a tree. The dwarf, who was a most capable person, and indeed, though one meets bad dwarfs, I never heard of a dwarf who was a fool, cut the fish open, cleaned them, and said, "Now what we want next is some firewood."
"We've got some up at the castle," said Edmund.
The dwarf gave a low whistle.
"Beards and bedsteads," he said. "So there really is a castle after all?"
"It's only a ruin," said Lucy.
The dwarf stared round at all four of them with a very curious expression on his face.
"And who on earth?"
he began, but then broke off and said,
"No matter, breakfast first. But one thing before we go on. Can you lay your hand on your hearts and tell me I'm really alive? Are you sure I wasn't drowned and we're not all ghosts together?"
When they had all reassured him, the next question was how to carry the fish. They had nothing to string them on and no basket. They had to use Edmund's hat in the end, because no one else had a hat. He would have made much more fuss about this if he had not by now been so ravenously hungry. At first the dwarf did not seem very comfortable in the castle. He kept looking round and sniffing and saying,
"Looks a bit spooky after all. Smells like ghosts, too."
But he cheered up when it came to lighting the fire and showing them how to roast the fresh pavanders in the embers. Eating hot fish with no forks and one pocket knife between five people is a messy business, and there were several burnt fingers before the meal was ended. But as it was now 9 o'clock, and they had been up since 5, nobody minded the burns so much as you might have expected. When everyone had finished off with a drink from the well and an apple or so, the dwarf produced a pipe about the size of his own arm, filled it, lit it, blew a great cloud of fragrant smoke, and said,
"Now,
you tell us your story first," said Peter, "and then we'll tell you ours."
"Well," said the dwarf, "as you've saved my life, it is only fair you should have your own way. But I hardly know where to begin. First of all, I'm a messenger of King Caspian's."
"Who's he?" asked four voices all at once.
"Caspian the 10th, King of Narnia, and long may he reign," answered the dwarf. "That is to say, he ought to be King of Narnia, and we hope he will be. At present he is only king of us old Narnians."
"What do you mean by old Narnians, please?" asked Lucy.
"Why, that's us," said the dwarf. "We're a kind of rebellion, I suppose."
"I see," said Peter. "And Caspian is the chief old Narnian?"
"Well, in a manner of speaking," said the dwarf, scratching his head. "But he's really a new Narnian himself, a Telmarine, if you follow me."
"I don't," said Edmund.
"It's worse than the Wars of the Roses," said Lucy.
"Oh, dear," said the dwarf, "I'm doing this very badly. Look here, I think I'll have to go right back to the beginning and tell you how Caspian grew up in his uncle's court, and how he came to be on our side at all, but it'll be a long story."
"All the better," said Lucy. "We love stories."
So the dwarf settled down and told his tale. I shall not give it to you in his words, putting in all the children's questions and interruptions, because it would take too long and be confusing, and, even so, it would leave out some points that the children only heard later. But the gist of the story, as they knew it in the end, was as follows.
Chapter 4. The Dwarf Tells of Prince Caspian. Prince Caspian lived in a great castle in the centre of Narnia with his uncle Miraz, the king of Narnia, and his aunt, who had red hair and was called Queen Pruneprismia. His father and mother were dead, and the person whom Caspian loved best was his nurse, and though, being a prince, he had wonderful toys which do almost anything but talk, he liked best the last hour of the day when the toys had all been put back in their cupboards, and nurse would tell him stories. He did not care much for his uncle and aunt, but about twice a week his uncle would send for him, and they would walk up and down together for half an hour on the terrace at the south side of the castle. One day, while they were doing this, the king said to him,
"Well, boy, we must soon teach you to ride and use a sword. You know that your aunt and I have no children, so it looks as if you might have to be king when I'm gone. How shall you like that, eh?"
"I don't know, uncle," said Caspian.
"Don't know, eh?" said Miraz. "Why, I should like to know what more anyone could wish for."
"All the same, I do wish," said Caspian.
"What do you wish?" asked the king.
I wish I could have lived in the old days," said Caspian.
He was only a very little boy at the time. Up till now, King Miraz had been talking in the tiresome way that some grown-ups have, which makes it quite clear that they are not really interested in what you are saying. But now he suddenly gave Caspian a very sharp look.
"Eh, what's that?" he said. "What old days do you mean?"
"Oh, don't you know, uncle," said Caspian, "when everything was quite different, when all the animals could talk, and there were nice people who lived in the streams and the trees, naiads and dryads they were called, and there were dwarfs, and there were lovely little fauns in all the woods. They had feet like goats and..."
"That's all nonsense for babies," said the king sternly, "only fit for babies, do you hear? You're getting too old for that sort of stuff. At your age, you ought to be thinking of battles and adventures, not fairy tales."
"Oh, but there were battles and adventures in those days," said Caspian. "Wonderful adventures. Once there was a white witch, and she made herself queen of the whole country, and she made it so that it was always winter. And then two boys and two girls came from somewhere, and so they killed the witch, and they were made kings and queens of Narnia. And their names were Peter and Susan and Edmund and Lucy. And so they reigned for ever so long, and everyone had a lovely time, and it was all because of Aslan."
"Who's he?" said Miraz.
And if Caspian had been a very little older, the tone of his uncle's voice would have warned him that it would be wiser to shut up. But he babbled on.
"Oh, don't you know?" he said. "Aslan is the great lion who comes from over the sea."
"Who has been telling you all this nonsense?" said the king in a voice of thunder.
Caspian was frightened and said nothing.
"Your Royal Highness,"
said King Miraz, letting go of Caspian's hand, which he had been holding till now, "I insist upon being answered. Look me in the face.
Who has been telling you this pack of lies?"
Nurse, faltered Caspian and burst into tears.
"Stop that noise,"
said his uncle, taking Caspian by the shoulders and giving him a shake.
"Stop it, and never let me catch you talking or thinking either about all those silly stories again. There never were those kings and queens. How could there be two kings at the same time? And there's no such person as Aslan, and there are no such things as lions, and there never was a time when animals could talk. Do you hear?"
"Yes, uncle," sobbed Caspian.
"Then let's have no more of it,"
said the king. Then he called to one of the gentlemen in waiting who were standing at the far end of the terrace and said in a cold voice,
"Conduct His Royal Highness to his apartments and send His Royal Highness's nurse to me at once."
Next day Caspian found what a terrible thing he had done. For nurse had been sent away without even being allowed to say goodbye to him, and he was told he was to have a tutor. Caspian missed his nurse very much and shed many tears, and because he was so miserable, he thought about the old stories of Narnia far more than before.
He dreamed of dwarfs and dryads every night, and tried very hard to make the dogs and cats in the castle talk to him. But the dogs only wagged their tails, and the cats only purred. Caspian felt sure that he would hate the new tutor, but when the new tutor arrived about a week later, he turned out to be the sort of person it is almost impossible not to like. He was the smallest and also the fattest man Caspian had ever seen. He had a long, silvery, pointed beard, which came down to his waist, and his face, which was brown and covered with wrinkles, looked very wise, very ugly, and very kind. His voice was grave, and his eyes were merry, so that until you got to know him really well, it was hard to know when he was joking and when he was serious. His name was Dr. Cornelius. Of all his lessons with Dr. Cornelius, the one that Caspian liked best was history. Up till now, except for Nurse's stories, he had known nothing about the history of Narnia, and he was very surprised to learn that the royal family were newcomers in the country.
"It was Your Highness's ancestor, Caspian the First," said Dr. Cornelius, "who first conquered Narnia and made it his kingdom. It was he who brought up all your nation into the country. You are not native Narnians at all. You are Telmarines. That is, you all came from the land of Telmar, far beyond the western mountains. That is why Caspian the First is called Caspian the Conqueror."
"Please, Doctor," asked Caspian one day, "who lived in Narnia before we all came here out of Telmar?"
"No men or very few lived in Narnia before the Telmarines took it," said Dr. Cornelius.
"Then who did my great-great-grandcestors conquer?"
"Whom, not who, Your Highness," said Dr. Cornelius. "Perhaps it's time to turn from history to grammar."
"Oh, please, not yet," said Caspian. "I mean, wasn't there a battle? Why is he called Caspian the Conqueror if there was nobody to fight with him?"
"I said there were very few men in Narnia," said the doctor, looking at the little boy very strangely through his great spectacles.
For a moment Caspian was puzzled, and then suddenly his heart gave a leap.
"Do you mean," he gasped, "that there were other things? Do you mean it was like in the stories? Were there—"
"Hush," said Dr. Cornelius, laying his head very close to Caspian's. "Not a word more. Don't you know your nurse was sent away for telling you about old Narnia? The king doesn't like it. If he found me telling you secrets, he'd be whipped, and I should have my head cut off."
"But why?" asked Caspian.
"It's high time we turn to grammar now," said Dr. Cornelius in a loud voice. "Will your Royal Highness be pleased to open Pulverulentus Sicus at the fourth page of his Grammatical Garden, or the Arbour of Accidents Pleasantly Opened to Tender Wits?"
After that it was all nouns and verbs till lunchtime, but I don't think Caspian learned much. He was too excited. He felt sure that Dr. Cornelius would not have said so much unless he meant to tell him more sooner or later. In this he was not disappointed. A few days later his tutor said,
"Tonight I'm going to give you a lesson in astronomy. At the dead of night, two noble planets, Tava and Alambil, were passed within 1 degree of each other. Such a conjunction has not occurred for 200 years, and Your Highness will not live to see it again. It will be best if you go to bed a little earlier than usual. When the time of the conjunction draws near, I will come and wake you."
This didn't seem to have anything to do with old Narnia, which was what Caspian really wanted to hear about, but getting up in the middle of the night is always interesting, and he was moderately pleased. When he went to bed that night, he thought at first that he would not be able to sleep, but he soon dropped off, and it seemed only a few minutes before he felt someone gently shaking him. He sat up in bed and saw that the room was full of moonlight. Dr. Cornelius, muffled in a hooded robe and holding a small lamp in his hand, stood by the bedside. Caspian remembered at once what they were going to do. He got up and put on some clothes. Although it was a summer night, he felt colder than he had expected and was quite glad when the doctor wrapped him in a robe like his own and gave him a pair of warm, soft buskins for his feet. A moment later, both muffled so that they could hardly be seen in the dark corridors, and both shod so that they made almost no noise, Master and pupil left the room. Caspian followed the doctor through many passages and up several staircases, and at last, through a little door in a turret, they came out upon the leads. On one side were the battlements, on the other a steep roof. Below them, all shadowy and shimmery, the castle gardens. Above them, stars and moon. Presently they came to another door, which led into the great central tower of the whole castle. Dr. Cornelius unlocked it, and they began to climb the dark, winding stair of the tower. Caspian was becoming excited. He had never been allowed up this stair before. It was long and steep, and when they came out on the roof of the tower and Caspian had got his breath, he felt that it had been well worth it. Away on his right he could see, rather indistinctly, the western mountains. On his left was the gleam of the great river, and everything was so quiet that he could hear the sound of the waterfall at Beaver's Dam a mile away. There was no difficulty in picking out the two stars they had come to see. They hung rather low in the southern sky, almost as bright as two little moons, and very close together.
"Are they going to have a collision?"
he asked in an awestruck voice.
"Nay, dear prince," said the doctor, and he too spoke in a whisper. "The great lords of the upper sky know the steps of their dance too well for that. Look well upon them. Their meeting is fortunate and means some great